Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our neighbor, I call him still our new neighbor and friend in Chapel Hill, is Joe Robinson. For 27 years, beginning in 1978 until about 10 years ago, in 2005, he was the principal oboist of the New York Philharmonic. I still can't get over that. And performed concerts and orchestral and chamber works all over the world in concert halls. And here he is, all of this to international acclaim and to the great interest of his friends here in North Carolina, who were amazed and really excited about his success. Well, now that he's back with us, he's agreed to come visit with us. And Joe, you've compiled a lot of these memories in response to the question we always ask you is, how did you get this job with the New York Philharmonic? And how did you persuade them to hire a country boy from North Carolina?
Well, now that I'm retired and still sort of playing out the string, you know, because there's some inertia in a career like mine, what I hear more often is, was that guy really in the New York Philharmonic?
Yeah.
So, I mean, a few more comments like that, I'll probably hang it up. But, The first question I usually really get from people is, how did you decide to play the oboe in the first place? You know, and I said, well, reluctantly, like most oboe players, I was a happy saxophone player in the junior high school band in Lenoir, North Carolina. So I really kind of never outgrew the band program that started me. And it was just such an unusual a program in Lenoir, one of the best half dozen
A lot of people in North Carolina still know about, I think it was Colonel Harper.
Captain Harper,
I guess. Yeah. And the Lenoir band, this mountain furniture town, why does it have such a good band and why does it go so many different places to play? And so there's a story there, I guess.
It used to be a furniture town.
But when you were there back then.
Our classmate Randy Austin took it to Vietnam. Anyway, but Captain Harper was, heir to a furniture fortune, and he spent most of his inheritance on this public high school band program, which included the best instruments in the world for free. And a fleet of buses and three sets of uniforms and 18 practice rooms in a brick building that rivaled the high school. We had 5 full-time faculty members attached to a public high school, and which had only about 450 people in it.
This with Captain Harper's money?
Mostly, yes.
Or maybe some of his friends contributed to, but mostly him.
No, I don't know if friends – I don't think he was a fundraiser. He just spent his own money. But he started this band because he thought American Legionnaires like himself could learn to play and march to their own music around the Confederate Monument in Lenoir on Armistice Day. Turned out to be a lot harder to play
get
these
older men to – he was trying to get the veterans themselves.
Yeah, well, and of course in 1924 they weren't that old yet, you know. So they had just come back from the war and they were probably –
1924. Oh, that's when he started.
Yeah.
The first World War veteran. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, so but they had a few disastrous rehearsals, and he said, forget this. So he gave the instruments to the high school and said, I'll stay for a year to get it going. And he got caught up in the whole thing, and he's the first high school band director ever elected president of the American Bandmasters Association, right up there with Sousa and famous bandsmen. So he stayed for 50 years and, invested his fortune and his life, in effect, his creative potential in this band program. I've said no board of directors of any foundation would ever have bought. That the premise was that, well, it's worth it, that these kids from a little mountain town have talent, the potential within them to express and achieve. I was by no means the only one from the band who went on to an important professional musical career. There were many of us.
Well, the lesson for me is that all across the state, all across the world, there are plentiful reservoirs of untapped talent that all they need is a Captain Harper or somebody to come identify that talent, massage it, build it, and that we're just missing. You know what we're missing by not having the Captain Harpers out there like you and me, why aren't we out there in some place sharing our talent? And,
well, we are.
Well, well, listen, I wanted to talk to you. I mean, I love talking about this great North Carolina town and the tradition that Captain Harper left. And you're, as you say, only one example, but maybe the most prominent example of what can happen and when the resources are applied. But you were playing the saxophone in that band. How'd you get to the oboe?
Well, I was a happy saxophone player, but I, and like most oboe students, was sort of converted because the band needed me to play the oboe. And that
does every high school band have an oboe player? Is there an oboe?
Eventually they got to have bassoonists and oboe players, mm-hmm. and maybe a bass clarinet or something, you know, in order to move into a higher grade of competition. So the Super Bowl in my life was the North Carolina State Band contest. And Lenore had won for 25 straight years before I even started. So we were caught up. Not only did we have this facilitative, you know, assistance, which is just practically unprecedented, we had this tradition of winning. And it was as motivating to us as it would be for a championship football team or any other sports activity. So the biggest thing, as I say, in my life was the state band contest. And we had to have an oboe player. And in fact, we had two or three of them. But I guess the only genius I know of who came out of Lenore, I mean, there might have been many, but the only one I knew really was William Happer, whose parents were Scots physicians who ran the public health service and who thought that his playing the oboe was a waste of time. So they put him to studying Russian or something, pulled him out of the band, and there I was, you know, with my saxophone.
So it's like in a football team when when you're playing tackle and the guard or the center drops out, would you move? And they said that to you.
That's
move
exactly
from saxophone
right.
to oboe? Anyway, what class were you in high school then?
Well, I started midway through my freshman year on oboe. Uh-huh. And I was already playing something in the state band contest, you know, 3 months later, which, I mean, I didn't play it very well. I wrote about that. So, no, as you said earlier, I mean, you know, my experience there really made a little D-Democrat out of me because it proves that there's potential in all of us everywhere to do, as you said, remarkable things, to excel if you have the right facilitative assistance, motivation, and aim high. And I think that's what was all part of this experience. So there's still, the principal bassoonist to the Dallas Symphony just retired last May after 50 years, and there's a percussionist still playing in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra in New York. So, but there are many. There's, you know, it's a kind of astonishing. That people – just proves that people can do anything.
That what? Who?
That people have it within them to do almost anything.
Yeah, that there are hidden talents in all of us,
yeah.
Unrealized. And in your case, had you not grown up in Lenore,
no,
the latent a talent would never have been honed in order to – well
– that's for sure because I tried to learn piano three different times. When I was 6, when I was 11, when I was 23. And all three teachers told my parents I had no talent for music. So it's remarkable how often it's a matter of finding the precise...
The right mentor or the person...
Or the right channel. I found the right instrument by accident because I could express... I sang in church choir. I could whistle better than most people. So I found this wind instrument that gave me kind of a natural outlet for making music. It suited me. Not the reed-making part, but playing the instrument. So,
well, this is interesting. We're answering, or Joe Robinson is promising to answer the question that I put to him, which is, how did you get the job in the New York Philharmonic? And he's going to share with us some music that he used to make that sale, but we can't do it on this segment because we're out of time. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with you. I'm visiting with Joe Robinson, the former principal oboe of the New York Philharmonic, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with my friend, longtime friend, college classmate, and friend for many years, who is now living in Chapel Hill. But also for many years, he was the principal oboe in the New York Philharmonic, playing for the renowned Zubin Mehta and playing all over the world. Now he's back in Chapel Hill, and we're getting him to tell war stories about how he got there. Joe, I want the question is, how did you get this job? And I was going to move to the tryouts. You took me to Lenoir.
Yeah, where the starting point.
Well, so you went to high school in Lenoir. I also know you went to college in Davidson, and we did call you Oboe Joe some. But you know, Davidson's not a conservatory. You weren't there to be trained to be a professional musician, were you?
No, my parents, too, were uncomfortable with my enthusiasm for a career in music. And my daddy said when I was 16 years old, and he called me over and he said, son, this oboe business is kind of, you know, it's like religion. Don't go off the deep end. That summer I went to Cincinnati Conservatory for one of their summer program.
Which this gave was me, between high school and college, or in?
No, this was between my junior and senior year in high school. And there are lots of these kinds of programs around the country because, you know, the facilities and teachers are underused in the summer. So, and it was also a way of recruiting, you know, to bring people to Cincinnati Conservatory from around the country. And so that was the first time I got a scholarship. And Daddy drove me to Cincinnati. Along the way, we stopped in Corbin, Kentucky to get some gas. And the guy said, there's a good chicken restaurant around the corner.
Oh, come on.
I'm serious.
Oh, come on.
We went up there, and a man in a white suit, he opened the door.
And this was and it was before the franchising?
It just happened.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it just happened.
Joe and I know we're talking about Colonel Sanders fried chicken, but maybe you're listening, maybe you're reminded now that we're talking about the first Colonel Sanders, and you were there.
And I was there. And my mother loved the chicken. So when he came around to ask, how do you like your dinner? Mother said, could I have the recipe for this chicken? And he had to say, no, ma'am, I'm sorry. I just sold it to somebody who's going to franchise. Well, we didn't know the concept.
Didn't know what franchising meant.
Yeah, we didn't know what that was.
This was like 1960.
57.
Okay,
57.
Wow.
So he said, well, I can't do it, but I'll give you my recipe for pecan pie. And my mother never fixed it any other way after that.
My golly.
Yeah, but there he was. Well, anyway, that was just on our way to Cincinnati.
All right, so you got Cincinnati.
Yeah, I got up there. And you know, it was my first look at the professional world. And it was also not the best time to see what life was like.
Were there other high school students there, or were you just bunch of others?
Yes, so, from Miami to New York.
And you're in residence for a couple of weeks or a month or
a
summer?
Six weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, 6 weeks program. So it's the first orchestra I ever played in.
So they're really giving you professional training, mentoring in the context of playing in a real orchestra.
Yeah.
So you're focusing.
It's the first time I played in an orchestra. And well, of course, they had a wind ensemble. They called it band. So, but there was a much better oboe player there than I was.
And what was his name?
His name was Carl Ellis. And he was a very eccentric fellow who acted much older than his years, but he played very beautifully. And he had a way, I've written about this, I said, you know, he could spin out a phrase that made me think of little puffy white clouds in a summer sky. And I was enchanted by them, but I didn't know how he did that. And because he was so good at it, I was content to be second oboe.
I'm sorry, I don't know. He would do this with his oboe or with his mouth? I mean, he's speaking or is he playing?
Oh, he's playing.
And playing, and playing. It's translating. He's playing so artistically and so well that it gets into your head and stirs up images.
Well, I think that's what all great musicians can do. They stir up images and stir up feelings, and that's why music itself is so powerfully communicative. I always thought of a beautiful phrase or a long tone is spun out through time, and it's therefore a kind of life metaphor. It comes from nowhere, emerges, reaches its highest point, like a flower blooming, and dies away. And so some of the poignancy of music has to do with its transience, the fact that it exists in a unique moment in time. It can be, of course, it can be preserved to some extent by recording, but I must have made 75 or 80 recordings with the New York Philharmonic, most of which don't seem to me to represent the playing that I was
doing.
The
same moment that you had when you're surrounded in the concert hall with the conductor surrounded and making from time to time, never exactly perfect, but done beautifully. And we don't capture that with the recordings. We don't have that experience with the recording.
Well, if I play a wrong note, it's obvious enough. But I would say for most of the recordings I made with the New York Philharmonic, I sound to myself like a generic American oboe player. And that's because when I first came to New York, we were doing recordings with Zubin Mehta for Columbia. And by that time, engineers, technicians had an idea of the Columbia sound. And a generation earlier, I would say people like Fritz Reiner in Chicago and George Zell in Cleveland were able to approach recording as a mirror of what they aspired to do, as a monument to what they and their orchestras could do. And the only objective then was to have perfect representation. So the first time I heard my own recording coming playing back in New York, I thought, what orchestra is that? Who is that? That's a Columbia. That's the Columbia sound. So, you know, it became more and more the art of the producers and the technicians than of the players. I mean, as an example, I was very worried about recording Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony with Leonard Bernstein, which happened in about 1989 with Deutsche Grammophon. Now, it's important because I'd seen Bernstein conduct this with the New York Philharmonic on television when I was about 15 years old. And my predecessor, Harold Gomberg.
The predecessor is principal oboist.
Principal oboist for 35 years. And because of all the TV that he and Bernstein shared, he was a very big man in much more, I'd say, prominent at that time when it seemed, you know, people had to watch what was being televised.
And the camera would go to the Prince Lobos he would be recognized in grocery stores in New York.
Yeah, he would. In fact, after they finished performing the Chike 4, Bernstein came through the orchestra. Harold could hardly wait to jump up. He held the oboe between his hands like a prize fighter. He waved it back and forth above his head. And people were still talking about his performance when I was there, you know, many, many years later. So then came my time to record Tchaikovsky 4, you know, with Leonard Bernstein.
So he's coming as a visiting conductor then?
I played with him for 10 years. He came and went.
He would come for special occasions? Is that the deal? And would come back and visit, and Zubin would make room for him?
Well, of course, Zubin couldn't conduct an entire season. We had a 52-week contract. So, you know, there were many guest conductors who came and went. Wow. I would say most of them.
But, I mean, so this is a thrilling moment. For you.
Definitely.
Here's Bernstein, and he knows this piece, and I've got to do it the way he wants to do it, but I want to do it the right way for me, too. I mean, what's going through your mind as you're approaching?
Look, you know, there's another thing about Harold Gomberg's approach to this particular solo. It's a very long-winded piece. It starts the second movement. And Harold was the first person, at least on television, who performed that whole thing without stopping to take a breath. He just kept going. It was like a pearl fisher.
I don't understand. I mean, this is – explain that to me.
Well, he just kept playing, you know.
He's got to take a breath.
No, he didn't take a breath in the whole thing, which is I'm not sure it depends on the tempo, but it's probably, you know, 40 seconds or it's not like staying underwater for two minutes or something. But to play like that, Bernstein is reported to have said in a rehearsal one day as he dropped to his knees, "Oh my God, put that in the time capsule." I mean, and he and Bernstein and Gomberg had been at Curtis together, and Bernstein made no secret of his you know, huge admiration for Harold de Gomberg. So when I first played for Bernstein, of course, I had – it's like Brahms hearing the tramp of Beethoven's feet behind him. I just kept hearing in my mind, you know, that's Harold Gomberg. How am I going to measure?
So you're thinking – I'm just putting words in your mouth. You're up there looking at Bernstein. You're saying Bernstein really wants Howard de Gomberg back.
Harold. Yeah.
De Gomberg.
Well,
back. How can I get in a place where he would like me better? Even, I mean, are you thinking this in your mind? What are you? What's
well,
going
not better. I'm just hoping that you know I'll be good enough. So, I mean, that actually started my second year when he conducted a tour to Asia, and that's the first time I actually played for him for like 5 weeks, and we did some orchestral repertory that had important oboe solos. The most important one was in Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. And throughout the tour, he hardly acknowledged me. Or look, he had a way of conducting that invited everybody's best work. He wasn't intimidating. He would love us into excellence. And he was so talented, he knew exactly how long a phrase needed to fulfill itself. So he was he was one of everybody's favorite conductor, you know. But at the end of the tour, we were on television. I didn't even know that. But we recorded Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. And at the end, he came through the orchestra and handed me a huge bouquet of roses. And that was on TV. And that was my official certification. I mean, now
what is – why? Was this for the whole tour or was this for this particular did this come from?
Well, we're talking about what music means. This symphony was written in 1945 by a Russian composer who just lived through hell and threatened by Stalin. And it's a very profound but somewhat cryptic work because – Shostakovich was trying to save his own life and his career by appeasing Stalin and the official critics of the day. So there are sort of secret messages in Shostakovich 5. The bombastic last movement is really quite ironic, in fact. But it worked. It worked. But the third movement is the one that is full of such anguish and pain. And in the middle of it, it's as if one moment – the clouds part, and there's this little glimmer of hope, which is the oboe solo descending from heaven.
So the oboe comes in.
That's the way it comes.
I mean, so I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. Yeah. I mean, this is a moment where you're both excited and scared to death that you're going to not do it exactly. Or I mean,
yeah.
It's right. Shooting the foul shot. When you're at the you're 1 point behind and you got two shots and
got to do it,
you can win the game.
It would have been even more nerve wracking if I'd known that we were recording it, but that always made things a little bit more dangerous. But it just happened. I had a good read, and I think people have admired that recording for 40 years. But I think I just sort of sent Lenny Bernstein to the moon that night, and that was more. But after that, I was okay with him. I was always okay. In fact, I'd have to turn my head quickly not to be kissed, you know, where I didn't want to be.
Well, kissed. Let's take a break.
Okay.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Joe Robinson. We're talking about his musical career. He was the principal oboist in the New York Philharmonic. He's now our neighbor here in Chapel Hill. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm listening with my friend Joe Robinson. Joe's among us here in Chapel Hill and really has been here for some time, but until 2005 and for 20, almost 30 years before that, he was the principal oboist for the New York Philharmonic. And he's given us the benefit. I brought him here to play some music, and he's telling us such good stories. I don't want him to stop. One of the things that we were talking about before were recordings, and we were talking about the moment of music and how the beauty of the art of music is somehow it's transience, that it's just here for a minute, and that took you into recording and the ups and downs of having these wonderful recordings of the music. I think I couldn't do without it because I could never get to New York to hear the Philharmonic, and now the recording makes it possible. But there's some downsides to it as well that you were talking about, the corporatization of music.
Yeah, I think that's happened in a lot of fields. I have friends who are physicians who talk about that's happening in medicine, that they think, in fact, my daughter, middle daughter Jody, is a doctor, and she, you know, feels that bean counters are forcing her to practice medicine in a way that she doesn't always think is best. But it's anyway, I would say that, you know, I came on board in New York at pretty much the high point of recording, you know, LPs first and then CDs.
When you came in the mid-70s, we were still doing 33s rather than – we weren't into CDs or – digital recording at that point.
Right. That came quickly thereafter. You know, and then we were doing this.
So, I mean, just looking at it, in your music collection, have you got LPs or have you got CDs?
Well, we had hundreds of LPs that have mostly been replaced by CDs, reissued. So we had a hard time getting rid of our collection of LPs. I mean, we still saved some that were heirloom.
But you're not like some people who say, oh, the LPs, the quality of them is so much better than the CDs because they've digitized it.
I'm not that much of an audiophile. but what I wanted to tell you, though, was that when I did finally record Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, which is, I say, the one that my predecessor sort of, that was his signature solo. I did it with Bernstein about 1989 for Deutsche Grammophon. And so I saw the engineer backstage and said, please, Herr so-and-so, just use one take of the big oboe solo. Please, just use one take.
Well, why did you say that? I mean, what was he going to combine?
Yes.
He was going to shuffle your best parts and...
No, that's what, yeah. I mean, he said, ach, no, he said, we have the most wonderful beginning for Thursday night. And then, and so when it came out, it's like a quilt. You know, there were four separate segments of my oboe solo. And in fact, I used four different reeds because every performance was a different, slightly different voice. So the thing that I aspire to, did always and still try to do, is artistic integrity, which means that the musical line, the time that the musical phrase exists, has to have its own sort of logical inevitability. It moves through time and obeys the laws of inertia. And to have someone just snip away because maybe there was in the second horn part a little bobble at the attack.
So they're a snip in your solo because somebody else makes a miscue.
Right, because they have to have a perfect template when the recording is finished. The engineer will come into trouble or criticism if it isn't, you know, perfect behind the solo. So, excuse me. But anyway, because Harold Gomburg played this without breathing, and my contention is he was afraid to take the reed out of his mouth.
Just for anybody who joined us late, 40 seconds. It's a 40-second piece that he could do and you could do, I guess, too, without in one breath.
Well,
and that's why your eyes bulge when you play this.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Turn red, crimson. I've had doctors ask, how in the world, you know, you must have blood pressure going through the roof. Well, but Harold did this, I think, as I said, I mean, being a little baby critical about this, but I think he was afraid to reposition the reed in his lips after taking a breath, so he just stayed put, and he toughed it out. And as I say, Bernstein swooned over this, and so I knew that when I played it, I was going to have to do the same thing. You know, it would be like a rite of passage. So the first thing that Zubin Mehta conducted when I joined the orchestra and he came in the summer of 78 was Tchaikovsky 4. And he said, let's start with the second movement.
He knew he...
Yeah, that's going to be a second.
Well, he's going to... Why? He should have checked this out before if he wanted...
Well, I think it was like another little mini audition. He was going to see if he still liked the player he chose, you know, 6 months earlier.
So, Joe, for those of us who don't understand about... You keep talking about reeds and repositioning reeds and the critical part of reeds. So what... Have you got to have a different reed for each piece, or
well, sometimes, you know, I mean, that's another whole.
All right, well, let's don't get well, let's come back to that. But yeah. In this particular time, you're thinking about the reed with a wind instrument, a saxophone or a clarinet or a oboe or a bassoon, I guess, is all these the
made of.
It's not like the cornet, which is the same all the time. The reed is something which is a expendable sort of thing.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I know.
And in this piece that you're talking about, why was he, what was the reed positioning? You talked about Harold having not to change the position of the reed all the way through. He was what's going on there?
Well, sometimes a reed is more self-sufficient and safer, therefore, than other times, when it might have to be held precisely at the tip in a certain way in order to sound acceptable. I mean, it's like a little demon that exists in most reeds that if they are revealed completely, something is going to come out and scare you or awake the cat. I mean, an oboe, I think its poignancy comes in part because it's so vulnerable. I mean, not only – first, it's made out of something called Arunda donax, which is the largest species of grass. So an oboist – for thousands of years, oboists have made music with a vibrating – with the blades of grass stuck into a wood pipe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of astonishing. But, of course, what we're trying to do is sing – with that stuff, that primitive stuff. And I didn't know when I switched from saxophone to oboe that I was going to be, you know, sentencing myself to a life at, you know, if not hard labor, very, very meticulous labor, even 10 hours a week when I was in New York, just carving cane. Because I would say typically I could use, well, I would use a lighter reed, an easier, brighter reed for Mozart than for Brahms.
But why, in all of the American genius for manufacturing and replacing craftsmanship with standard parts, why hadn't somebody figured out a way to do that with for oboe reeds?
People have tried, you know, to come up with synthetic materials, and up to a certain point, they're plastic reeds or other synthetic material reeds that do hold up, but. I don't know, it's a little bit like saying, why don't we just play plastic violins? The natural material, you know, has its own character that is sometimes way more beautiful and promising, even if it's, you know, doesn't last. But in any case, if Harold, I mean, it's just my view that maybe that's why he didn't take a breath, but when Zubin said, let's start with the second movement, it was going to be like a second audition, as I say, a sort of rite of passage, you know, puberty rite. So I took, you know, sucked the air out of Avery Fisher Hall and went at it and made it through to the other side. And the colleagues in the orchestra shuffle their feet, which is the sign of approval. And Zubin said, stop, stop. What are you trying to do? Maybe you don't have to breathe, but I do. This is not a circus. This is music.
Well, what did he expect you to find a place to take the breath during the solo?
Yeah. There's a perfect place in the middle where the music starts over again in the same way.
But you knew that Harold had done it all the way through, and you figured you. Now, when you did it over again, did you follow Zubin's instructions and take a little breath?
Oh, yeah. Of course, it's much more comfortable. But very happy. Very happy. The only time I had to play it again without breathing was for Deutsche Grammophon that time in about, you know, when I recorded it with Bernstein. But by that time, I could circular breathe, which meant I could continue playing while I inhaled.
We're going to do a separate program on circular breathing because you don't have time now. We got to take a break.
Okay.
If you join us late, I'm visiting with Joe Robinson. We're talking about his career as the principal oboist of the New York Philharmonic, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with my friend Joe Robinson, who lives here in Chapel Hill. He's world famous as the former principal oboist for the New York Philharmonic, and he's been telling us a few tales. Joe, how'd you get the job? How did you persuade Zubin Mehta to hire you as the principal oboist in New York Philharmonic? What's the story?
Well, I remember when I was in high school telling my best friend one afternoon after the Philharmonic had been on television, I said, you know, I like playing the oboe, but I would never want that job. Even if I just thought going to New York City and trying to deal with it would be just too much oboe. Right. So, and as I mentioned earlier, I kind of hedged my bets by going to Davidson College.
All right, but now we got 2 minutes to tell us. How'd you get the job?
Well, I applied too late. I mean, first of all, you know, a principal oboe position might come open in a major orchestra once in a generation, 30, 40 years. So when the New York Philharmonic announced its opening, I had already lost 4 or 5 auditions in a row in places like St. Louis and Montreal and Boston. So my wife said, you know, don't waste your time. You're going to get hurt. And then I said, well, look, this may never come open again. I'll always regret it if I don't try. Well, then I applied too late. I was on tour with the Cleveland Orchestra playing assistant in Mexico. And I got back up. Then I tried to apply. And they said, sorry, all the available positions are filled with qualified people. So you're not going to – we'll get back in touch with you if the process is inconclusive. And it turned out to be that after 30 people played, the committee deadlocked in a disagreement with Zubin Mehta about whom to hire. That's when I got the call. So they said, if you want to play, you can come up in a couple of weeks. And I did. And it was a very famous oboist walking circles around in the backstage while I played an extraordinarily long audition. I'd fallen off the radar screen by then. I mean, I was really a long shot because even though I played for 6 years as principal oboe with Robert Shaw in Atlanta, I'd been teaching at North Carolina School of the Arts and was just, you know, forgotten. So anyway, I played the longest audition I've ever heard about and was on my way back to LaGuardia to fly home thinking, good grief, I might win this thing. So I knew I'd played pretty well, and anyway, I went off on a quintet tour with the faculty members from School of the Arts. We were in Virginia when Mary Kay, my wife, called and said, well, I've heard from the New York Philharmonic, and they're going to hear 2 players again, but you are not one of them. But the personnel manager, Jimmy Chambers, gave me his home telephone number and made me promise that you will call him immediately. He has to talk to you. So, of course, I was disappointed. I mean, you can never – it's like, well, you didn't win the lottery, although you –
But you were good.
Yeah, 7 out of 8 numbers, but you didn't win. So, anyway, it's very unusual for, an official in the organization to make a phone call, much less hand out his home phone. So I called him, and he said – for 20 minutes, he praised my playing. And finally, I said, well, Jimmy, why am I not still in it? And he said, Zubin thinks your tone is too strong – for the Philharmonic, which is impossible considering how heroic, what a big league orchestra that is, and how heroic my predecessor was. So I just couldn't accept that judgment. If he had said, oh, you fumbled this some things, you played the wrong rhythm, you were out of tune.
So you wrote him a letter.
I wrote it.
Tell it real quick.
I got up at 3 in the morning and wrote on Holiday Inn Stationery. I wrote and I said, yeah, Jimmy, you won't make a mistake by hiring either of these other 2 players. They're great. But you are making a mistake by, rejecting me if tone is the issue. And he called back after about a week and he said, your letter arrived. It could not have been more persuasive or fortuitous. I read it to Zubin in Los Angeles, and he said, if he believes in himself that much, I will hear him again. Mm.
And that's the – we're out of time. It brings tears to my eyes, the story. But your letter, both in terms of the persistence but also in terms of the gentlemanly way in which you presented it, brought Zubin Mehta around. And the history of the world changed –
well,
as you became principal, and we'll tell the story, the rest of that story. But that's such a great story to me, Joe Robinson, and I'm glad that something in your mountain upbringing and Davidson education in North Carolina persistence led you to write that letter in such a beautiful way, so that we were able to follow you. And we plan to share some some of Joe's music with you, and you're just going to have to come back, and we'll do a music program.
Great. I love it. Thank you, D.G.
Thanks to Joe Robinson. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.